Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Save big money on your outdoor project at Menards. Take the guesswork out of landscaping with our free, easy-to-use design program. Plus, Menards has the largest in-stock selection of concrete landscape blocks at the best prices. Get started on your dream landscape now. Visit us in-store or on Menards.com to see our full selection of landscape blocks and get your project started today.
Save big money at Menards.
The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to Pod on the Tyne, your go-to Newcastle United podcast brought to you by The Athletic. On the show this week, another great game for the neutral, but when, oh when, will Newcastle find that first win? From Paul Robinson to Sean Longstaff, is Newcastle a nightmare for youngsters? And when Ticking Along meets Tiki Taka, yes, we'll be having an in-depth look into Steve Bruce's tactics. No, really, honestly, we will. Hello, I'm Taylor Payne, and this is Pod on the Tyne. And joining me, as always this week, are The Athletic's Newcastle United correspondent, Chris Woff, and our senior writer, George Calkin. How are we doing, fellas? George, how are you?
Yeah, I'm all right. I can answer all of those questions that you've just asked. Who cares about neutrals? That's the first thing to
True.
Say.
Yeah.
And when will we win? When we play Norwich? Is Newcastle a nightmare Good. For youngsters? No, it's a nightmare for everybody. And Steve Good. Bruce's tactics, who are we trying to kid? Come on, move on.
Nice one. That's all from Pod on the Tyne this week. We'll speak to you next week. Cheers. Bye-bye.
See you all next week.
Nice and chirpy start there, George. Lovely stuff.
Thank you.
Chris, how are you? What you been looking into this week, apart from bin bags full of various offcuts of meat, I presume?
Is that a euphemism for me dealing with Newcastle United, or is that what I actually do in real life? I mean, that's a...
yeah.
That's no way to refer to the team.
It has been awful, hasn't it, Chris?
Oh, no.
I have been looking into... I was at... the game on Saturday at Vicarage Road, and I looked into that match. And obviously, we're going to discuss it more later. But basically, about how Newcastle now are the game that the team, every neutral want to watch their matches because there's so many goals in them. But the issue is Newcastle fans won't so much because their team can't win. So that is primarily what I've been looking at.
Yeah, but sorry, they were last on Match of the Day. Can I just point that out? So if they're so great for the neutrals, good,
well, that's what I mean. That was always going to be the issue, though, wasn't it? When it was Man City against Chelsea, and then Man United missing a penalty in the 91st minute or whatever it was. The game itself was. If you were neutral watching the game on Saturday,
Norwich playing Leeds and Everton playing whoever they played, I don't know.
Well,
maybe that was Sunday.
That'll be that giant Premier League conspiracy theory yet again, stopping us from enjoying ourselves. That's what that is.
Anyway, fine. Sorry, Chris, I interrupted.
That's quite all right. I was, I'd sort of lost my train of thought. So,
good.
But just on a separate note, George got offended when I spoke to him earlier today because I went to a pub quiz last night and he made a sort of joke about, oh, if you need someone extra to come and join your team, and I was basically like, well, definitely not you, George. But he's adamant that quizzes of the pub variety or something he can actually do, so maybe we should bring it back, Taylor. Maybe the quiz should be brought back.
No, I've got decent general knowledge. I can, if there's like a music round, I'm quite good at that, as long as it's music from the 80s, and you're too young for that. If I'm asked specific questions to do with football or my job,
as long as it's nothing to do with the actual thing that you get paid to do, George?
Yes, that's true. I try to banish all thought of that from my head. obvious reasons.
Excellent.
Anyway, how are you, Taylor?
I'm all right, mate. Yeah, I've been a bit under the weather this week. I've had a little bit of a sniffle, sore throat, but I'm okay now. There is quite a lot of it about, but I'm a lot better now, and I'm feeling absolutely giddy at the prospect of spending another hour or so in the presence of you two lads. So let's crack on, shall we?
In the pleasance, yeah, let's do that.
In the pleasance. The Athletic are still offering 33% off new subscriptions to podcast listeners. So get yourself over to theathletic.com/NewcastlePod to take advantage of that special offer.
Come on, you Maggies.
Right then, Watford 1, Newcastle United 1, another week. And another result that got away from us down at Vicarage Road. Let's start there. Newcastle, Chris, were incredibly profligate, weren't they? And let's be honest, they should have been out of sight by half-time. But yet again, we've only managed to come away with the 1 point.
Yeah, it was absolutely extraordinary. The goal they scored was from one of the more difficult opportunities they had as well. Arguably, Ben Foster should have saved it, but that's not a takeaway from how good a strike it was from Sean Longstaff, who had been presented with the same opportunity twice before that. I'm not sure what highlights people have seen elsewhere, but basically exactly the same thing had happened from two corners where the ball had gone to Sean Longstaff. He'd put the other two over the bar, but this one went into the top corner.
The second one he put wide, I was convinced it was in.
Yeah, it
was so close.
But, I mean, in terms of open play, Newcastle shifted to the system. They actually lined up when they first lined up at the start of the game. Isaac Hayden was stood as a right centre back as if it was going to be a five, as if they were going to play the five. And then immediately, about 15 seconds in, he moved further forward and sort of sat behind the base of the midfield. So it changed. They did play in a 4-3-3.
Cunning.
That's a quick change, that, isn't it? That's quick.
Cunning. No, that's a cunning attempt at dissembling.
Watch this, lads.
The
they'll never suss this one out.
Well, it worked, to be fair, in terms of it did bamboozle Watford to a certain degree. Newcastle going forward, Sam Maximan, in a strange sort of way, wasn't as central as he has been in other games, but equally he still put in a couple of excellent passes to his teammates. He also should have scored when he intercepted a terrible back pass from Craig Cathcart. But the likes of Sam Maximan, Almiron, bombing forward, he was actually playing an attacking position again, looked so much better in that role. Joe Willock, despite Steve Bruce having ruled him out on Friday, Joe Willock starts and then shows his fitness and actually marauds forward in the box as well. Joe Linton, first half, had arguably, I think, one of his best games for Newcastle in terms of his effectiveness. But the problem was they just couldn't actually put the ball into the back of the net, and it's just that same old story of it felt inevitable. Once it got past the hour mark and Newcastle had only scored once, it felt inevitable what was going to happen.
Great for the neutrals, George, wasn't it? But like you said at the top of the show, who cares about the neutrals? Who cares?
Why do people keep mentioning neutrals? Are there any neutrals listening to this podcast? I very much doubt it. If so, why are you wasting
some
your
Swiss
time
people
on this
maybe
rubbish? Yes, it's possible. It's possible. I mean, I said last week that if Newcastle are going to be terrible at football, or they're, you know, terrible at getting results, I prefer them to be terrible this way than last season's way, when they just sat there and did nothing and waited for the opposition to kind of dribble the ball around them and score. So it is it's sort of topsy turvy. I mean, I think you said something like on Twitter on Saturday at one point, I can't believe this or something. What did you say, Tony? You said something like that, didn't you?
I just couldn't believe that we hadn't won the game, and it was when we were 1-0 up, it genuinely looked like there was only one team going to win it, and we should have been 3-4-0 up by half time. And when it went to 1-1, I just thought it's so typical of us, but I just couldn't believe that we had done it again. It's almost like they never learn from their mistakes, you know?
So I've spent literally nanoseconds working on this stat, okay? So it's almost certainly wrong. Chris might be able to tell me. This time last season, after 6 games against West Ham, Brighton, Spurs, Burnley, Man United and Wolves, Newcastle had mustered 34 shots, both on target and off target, so in total, which is an average of 5.66 shots per game. This season, after games against West Ham, Villa, Southampton? Yes, Man United, Leeds and Watford, Newcastle have mustered 66 shots, which is an average of 11 per game.
So we're shooting more.
So we're shooting almost twice as much. Almost twice as much as this time last season. And I think that is fairly... And please, if that is wrong, I honestly don't care at all. That does tell us something, doesn't it? I mean, so in none of those games last season did Newcastle get into double figures in terms of shots. And in every game, apart from Villa and Manchester United, perhaps not surprisingly, Newcastle haven't got into double figures in terms of shots, but they've still got to 8 and 9. So there definitely has been a change in the way Newcastle are approaching matches. I mean, I know that how rudimentary that stat is, but it is kind of better. And as I said before, I am being stupid, but I would prefer to win a game 1-1 by having 9 million shots and not taking chances than I would, doing absolutely nothing all game and then having one lucky breakaway and doing that. So there's a definite change going on. I am, you know, worried about the lack of wins, but at least there is something. It's more progressive, isn't it? It's more progressive. It's a more progressive way of being rubbish.
It's certainly more progressive than sitting on the edge of your own box and waiting for the other team to shoot, which is what we were doing before. It is more progressive in that respect. But the sucker punch, Chris, came again from a poorly defended set piece. At the minute, it kind of feels like every time Newcastle face a corner, that something dangerous is going to happen. And of course, there was a flick on and then Saar pulled away at the back post and nodded at home. This keeps happening, doesn't it? They don't look particularly organised back there.
Well, they keep conceding sloppy goals. I mean, the thing, again, about what I'm going to say is that actually in the Watford game, this doesn't actually apply as much. So I thought the piece that I wrote after the game was sort of explaining this, that Newcastle are in this new expansive way and actually they are creating these opportunities and they missed loads on Saturday and they're creating a lot of opportunities against their teams. But they are then shipping so many chances to the opposition as well. So in Newcastle's games this season, their matches average 3.5 goals per game across both teams, but Newcastle are only scoring 1.2 of those. They're conceding 2.3 themselves per game, and that is the problem.
All right.
At the
moment. All right, Mr. Stats. All right, I bring out a stat, and you have to try and go one better. Bloody hell! It's like I pull a knife, you pull a gun. That's the Chicago way. That's the way you get Capone. Wow, is my stat right? Was my stat right?
Probably not.
I haven't looked at that specific stat, but in terms of season on season, Newcastle are having far more opportunities. So in the 2019-20 season, across the course of the whole season, they averaged 10.5 shots per game. It was 10.4 last season. They're up to 14.2 so far this year. Shots on target are up. Goals haven't actually translated into goals. Expected goals are up, but the actual goals haven't translated to going up too much. They're missing too many opportunities.
All these stats and XG, it's all lovely, isn't it? But if you don't put the ball in the net, then it doesn't mean anything.
Well, that's a problem. And again, the crucial issue is there's no Callum Wilson at the moment. And they've made the decision not to play with the centre-forward. I mean, Dwight Gayle came on to play his first 8 minutes of the season or however long he played on Saturday. Joe Willock clearly isn't 100% fit yet, although he is becoming more effective. He's not quite getting in the same positions as last season. I'm going to write about that for later in the week. And so if they don't have that, I mean, I think they've only won 2 of the 15 games Callum Wilson's missed since he's been at Newcastle. They're so reliant on Callum Wilson's goals and they desperately need him back.
That's the thing with stats. You can use stats to prove anything, can't you? And at the moment, as we've said already, you can use them to prove that Newcastle United are very bad. But who cares about stats when you have to deal with Jacob Murphy going through 1-on-1 with a goalkeeper in the last few minutes of the game to seal all 3 points? And let's be honest, John Anderson is all of us, isn't he, in this situation?
Can he play a colleague through? It's Jacob Murphy released. Murphy 1-on-1. Jacob Murphy to win it. Just put it in the net!
You don't want to get on the wrong side of Ando ever. Man. Who's, you know, he still has the most murderous eyes in football, but it's just brilliant. Yeah, I want that as a ringtone.
Absolutely, right? That should be a message alert. You know, when you get a message through, that should come out. That's amazing.
Yeah,
he had another one in the first half as well when St Maximin had that chance off the back pass, and it came to Longstaff and it went over the bar, and he shouted again, "Put it in the net!" It just sums it up, doesn't it? Everything to do with being a Newcastle fan is summed up in that few seconds.
I want to jump a little bit to the defence of Jacob Murphy.
Oh, you would. Are we? Come on, because
it was an abysmal finish, but he also he tried to replicate the goal that he scored away at Man City when he did exactly the same thing in 2018. He had exactly the same finish. He was clean through on goal and he scored at the Etihad. And it's a finish he clearly knows well. Yes, he cocked it up. Yes, it was an awful finish. But if that's what he's confident doing, it was so frustrating to watch and he should have scored. But I'm not quite on board with the idea that he just should never try that finish. If he scored that way before, I haven't got that.
No. You've got this wrong. We have not come here to bury Jacob Murphy. We have come here to praise John Anderson.
I wasn't just talking about this is a positive, it's not a negative. I think he's coming for a bit of flack elsewhere. And I just wanted to defend him a little bit.
He should have scored though, Chris, shouldn't he? Come on. I mean, you're allowed to say when someone's missed a chance, was shit.
I haven't got a problem with that, but it's the idea that he should never have tried that finish. He scored with that finish before. It's clearly a finish he's usually confident with. He completely cocked it up on that occasion, but just jumping to his defence a little bit.
For me, when he's running at pace like that, it's just touch it to the side around the goalkeeper. The keeper's got no chance. He squared him up. Just chop it to the side and put it past him. I know it sounds easy, me sitting here as a overweight man with asthma can tell everyone how to score goals, but, you know, like, it just...
But we've done this before. It's like the Panenka. It's like the sort of Panenka argument. And my argument that you can take a good penalty and miss and score with a bad penalty. I know that the bigger picture is if you score, that's the end. But with a finish like that, you're running. There are so many things that can go wrong. I mean, I think that's the sort of point that I would make. Whereas if you just twat it, you've got more of a chance of it.
I can understand him. Chris, I can understand him doing it if we were 2 or 3-1 up.
Yes.
I can understand it then. You know, trying to put a little bit of finesse on the end, stick the cherry on the cake, that kind of thing. But when it's to win the game and it's 2-1, it's to go 2-1 in the 88th minute or wherever it was, you don't want to be faffing around. You just want to put it in. Put the ball in the net, as John Anderson says. Let's live our life by those rules.
Just put the ball in the net. That's good. There was a lot of anger coming out. There was I think there was a good 10 years of frustration. You know, Ando, who has to sit through, I mean, as you know, Chris does, but who has to sit through every game, home and away, week in, week out, and thinking, you know, do it in a way that's neither boring nor repetitive, whatever. There was a lot of frustration coming out in that.
Ando and Razor are great, though. I really enjoy listening to their commentary. It's fantastic stuff. Yeah. Just a quick question that's came in from the real-time feed on the Athletic app. Martin T asks, where do you see our first win actually coming from? At this rate, Christmas songs will be on the radio before we get 3 points. George, what do you reckon?
It's Christmas time. I've already answered this, Martin. It will be Newcastle at home to Norwich on December the 1st. So by which time, yes, indeed, there will be a lot of Christmas songs on the radio.
Which current Newcastle player do you think would sing a Christmas song? Because, you know, obviously we've had like Gazza and people singing previously. Who would you select to sing your Christmas song from the Newcastle God?
Chris, are you injecting whimsy into the running order without any kind of pre-approval?
What is happening here? Stats.
What are you doing?
Really annoying stats and now whimsy. So, in other words, okay, well, do it a slightly different way. If Newcastle were to get to a cup final... and there was... I can't even finish that. And they were to release a cup final single, who would be the sort of John Barnes, as it were? Or, you know, who would be the main... I've got no idea. I don't even know why I'm persisting with this nonsense. I think Jolinton could do a sort of quite good Ozzy Ardiles sort of cameo. I would quite like that.
Try and do the voice. Do the voice, George.
I can't even remember. I was trying to do that. I can't even... Ozzy's gone to
Wembley.
I can't remember what the...
In the Cup for Tottingham. That's the one.
Yeah. I don't know. There's no obvious pop stars are in there.
Not in amongst our squad at the moment. Alan St. Maximin probably, I think, is the closest thing we've got to a rock star, isn't
it?
Yeah,
of course. Let's be honest.
Jeff Hendrick.
Jimi Hendrix. Let's move on. This is absolute waffle. Anyway, we'll be back in a second. Right then, here we go again. Alan Shearer followed up his chat with Andy Carroll by catching up with another former Newcastle striker. When you're putting together a list of names that got away, Paul Robinson is not necessarily near the top, but he broke into a star-studded squad when Newcastle had genuine European pedigree and showed a rare eye for goal as well. So why did he decide to leave the club, and why didn't things go to plan at Wimbledon? George, tell us a little bit more about Paul Robinson and his post-Newcastle career and the discussion he had with The Athletic this week.
So the whole idea behind this piece was that in his other gig on Match of the Day, Alan Shearer talked about the time that Paul Robinson asked to take one of his penalties. And that was the famous game, Sir Bobby's first home match as Newcastle manager. They beat Sheffield Wednesday 8-0 and Alan scored five, including two penalties. And Paul Robinson asked to take the second penalty. And as he put it in the interview, Alan's response, couldn't remember Alan's exact response, but the second word was off. And the reason he mentioned this on Match of the Day was because Richarlison had tried to nab a penalty for Everton when Dominic Calvert-Lewin was the penalty taker. And it was the only time that happened in Alan's career. So that got him thinking. And of course, August comes around every year and it's the anniversary of the incredible, dramatic, apocalyptic 2-1 home defeat to Sunderland when Paul Robinson started and Silvio Maric ahead of Shearer and Duncan Ferguson, and of course it turned out to be Ruud Gullit's last match. Robinson was the young Sunderland supporting player who was in the team and then had been around the first team. By the end of that season, he left for Wimbledon, something that he described as the worst decision in his life. Didn't play and then kind of embarked on this like mazy sort of career, but really falling out of love with football and ended up moving away from the game, came back in non-league, went bankrupt, has done all variety of jobs and is now a delivery driver back in the Northeast. So it's a sort of very interesting human interest story. And but yeah, I mean, and kind of one of those sliding door things. I'm not saying, you know, I don't think Alan thinks that if that Sunderland result had gone the other way, he would have fallen out of football, because he wouldn't. But he would have left Newcastle, and I'm sure he would have gone to another very, you know, he'd have gone to a big club. But he said that was it was this power play, and you know, if Newcastle had won, you know, what would Paul Robinson have ended up doing? You know, would he have stayed at Newcastle? How would his career panned out? You know, there would be no statue of Shearer on Barrett Road. He wouldn't be Newcastle's leading goal scorer, and life could have gone in a very different direction. I mean, for Paul, it's been incredibly traumatic and difficult, a lot of it. And so, yeah, it's one of those kind of fascinating stories.
It's a story that we hear quite a lot, though, isn't it, George? A young footballer, you know, the career goes wrong, financial difficulties, etc., lead to other problems, and then eventually the you know, misery ensues. But it's really hard when you When you have to listen to that, isn't it? And like you say, it's a sliding doors moment. And on the one hand, it kind of made Alan Shearer at Newcastle. But on the other hand, it had a different effect on Paul Robinson completely. What do we remember about Paul as a player, Chris?
I don't remember that much about Paul as a player, to be perfectly honest, because I was quite young. I was about, I was 7 years old, I think, then.
It's not an excuse, Chris.
I mean, the association I have with Paul Robinson is that moment with Alan Shearer when he has to take the penalty and doesn't get to take the penalty, and then obviously the Sunderland game, that is where what he has been remembered for. But when you speak to people, and obviously Sir Bobby Robson gave him a few opportunities as well after Ruud Gullit had, he was a player who clearly had some talent, and then he went to non-league football and scored a heck of a lot of goals, didn't he, George?
Oh yeah, he did. Yeah, I mean, I do remember him. I'm not sure that I ever thought he was particularly you know, in the Shearer bracket of player, but he was very willing. He had an absolute fearlessness, as you would say. I mean, he's still very similar as a bloke. I don't think he's changed as a sort of man. He's like a motor mouth, and he's kind of very chirpy and chatty in spite of the sort of difficulties he's been through. And yeah, there was this fearlessness. And as he said, there was an arrogance about him. The previous week before the Sunderland game, Shearer had actually been suspended because he'd been sent off in an earlier match. And he played pretty well. And it was in his mindset that if he was in the team ahead of Alan Shearer, that it was because he was better than him. And, you know, that sounds ridiculous now. But of course, football, I mean, you know, Shearer was the same at one point. He came into the Southampton team at 17 and he was taking somebody else's place. I mean, that's what football is, week in, week out. You're kind of battling with people to take their place or to hold them off. And so he got in the team and the manager decided to pick him. So, but one of the sort of interesting things he said was that at 21, he stopped learning. That was the point, he stopped learning. He got in the team and that was it. He'd made it. And I mean, it had been a sort of ridiculous rise for him. But, you know, whereas someone like Shearer had to adapt his game over the course of his career and had to change and, you know, became a different kind of player, he just didn't learn anything. And he lived at home at the time and he moved to Wimbledon. And, you know, sometimes we talk about people's bodies not being kind of brilliantly equipped for football. Sometimes people just aren't sort of ready for it mentally. And I don't think he had the maturity necessary. He struggled. He was in a hotel. Had nobody to talk to. Then he was put in a kind of tower block. He described it as a shithole, and you know, he just didn't know kind of what to do with himself, and sort of fell out with people. And it sounds, I mean, football can be, certainly back then, can be sort of, you know, could be very negligent. And he sort of said, he spoke to the manager at Wimbledon, Terry Burton, and said, "Why aren't you playing with me?" And he alleges that Burton said to him, "Well, you're not the player we thought we were signing." And so that was that. I mean, it was kind of very arbitrary. And so he fell out of, you know, he fell out of love very, very quickly, but probably didn't have the sort of, you know, the mentality to sort of, to thrive and learn. And it was only right at the end of his career again that he rediscovered that. And it's, the nice part of the story is that he's now coaching. His middle kid is playing for Sunderland and Middlesbrough's academy as well. And the coaching he's doing, he says it's not just talented players; it's people who can't kick a ball but want to smile. And so, you know, very nice sort of stuff. He does that one-on-one coaching at weekends, and then he's kind of getting messages from parents saying, "Oh, you know, our lad scored in the penalty this lunchtime. He's absolutely made up. That's never happened." Some have gone into Sunday League, but it's about, you know, football as enjoyment, which of course it should be. And he didn't have that for a lot of his career, and has kind of come back to kind of rediscover that, which is a very nice, you know, which is a kind of very nice epitaph.
Absolutely. And Chris, Newcastle youngsters, we don't tend to produce too many of them, do we? Sean Longstaff obviously had a good moment this week, but, you know, his time at Newcastle and more notably probably his brother's as well has been very haphazard. Is there something in the air at Newcastle? I mean, you know, there's Jermaine Genesis' famous fishbowl comment. Or is the city just a uniquely difficult place for young, affluent men to ply their trade? Is there something about Newcastle which just doesn't lend itself well to producing youth players?
Well, mentioning Sean Longstaff, I mean, Matty Longstaff has struggled a little bit since going up to Aberdeen on his loan spell. He's been left out of the last two matchday 11s, hasn't got on either, so it hasn't started particularly well for him up in Scotland. And I don't think it is the case that the youngsters can't come through at Newcastle and do well. Obviously, historically, Newcastle have produced some wonderful players, the likes of Gazza and Chris Waddle and Beardsley. I know Beardsley went elsewhere and then came back, but still, he was still and the local talent that there is. I don't necessarily take that point on board. Newcastle in its current incarnation, I don't think have done well enough to nurture their young talent. I don't think, to be fair, even pre-Mike Ashley towards sort of the mid-2000s, I don't think enough young players came through and really made their way. And that's something Newcastle really should address. It's the one thing I've never understood. I mean, there's so many things I've never understood about the Mike Ashley era. But in terms of this idea of self-sustainability and also wanting to sort of save money on transfer fees and the like, well, the best way of doing that would be to make the academy so good that players were able to make the step up and push from the under-23s, obviously, into the first team. That hasn't happened regularly enough at Newcastle. There hasn't been enough investment in that. There hasn't been enough focus on that. And so I think that's more of a problem rather than Jermaine Genesis's fishbowl comment. I think for him coming from elsewhere and into Newcastle, it probably was different. But I think for a lot of youngsters who grow up in the area and understand it, I don't think that is so much of an issue. I think that just that there isn't that necessarily that pathway that there should be.
Okay, well, fingers crossed. Obviously, Steve Harper's the man in charge now of our youth setup, so fingers crossed he should start taking us in the right direction. And if you want to read that that piece by Alan Shearer with Paul Robinson, get yourself onto theathletic.com and pick up a subscription. Right, we'll be back in just a moment. So, our next match is away at Wolves. It's another winnable fixture. Well, at least it should be. But it'll be Steve Bruce's 95th match in charge of Newcastle, and there's still no discernible tactical template. Let's talk about some of the things we still don't know about Steve Bruce's Newcastle United. Chris, let's start with up front. With and without Callum Wilson, we're like two completely different prospects, aren't we? But the nearest like for like that we have in the squad would be Dwight Gayle, but he's not getting a kick of the ball, is he?
It just seems a strange concept to me that Newcastle are so reliant on Callum Wilson's goals when he's fit. You give Dwight Gayle a 3-year contract, and then when Wilson's out and Newcastle are missing a hatful of opportunities, they missed some decent chances against Leeds as well, and Dwight Gayle didn't even get on that game, and then he only came on for the final 7 or 8 minutes at Watford and barely got a kick by that stage because the momentum had already shifted away from Newcastle. I don't really understand. I don't think that Dwight Gayle is quite as good an all-round player as Callum Wilson. He obviously doesn't have the same top-flight record as Callum Wilson, but he is a striker and he is in the squad. He's a finisher. I don't understand. If he's not going to play when Callum Wilson isn't fit and Newcastle need goals, when is he going to play? So I just can't. I don't understand that one at all.
Yeah, me neither. George, what's your thoughts on this? I mean, up front is where the problem is at the minute, and obviously the lack of cutting edge against Watford was a major thing. What's your thoughts on Dwight Gayle?
Well, why has he been given a 3-year contract or whatever the contract is? I mean, that's the thing that we don't understand. And I think those 7 minutes against Watford were his first league minutes this season, weren't they, Chris?
Yes.
Thank you. Bit of a delay there, but while you racked your huge brain for the answer, but thank you. And yeah, so I don't understand it. I mean, I don't think any of us seriously think that Dwight Gayle is the answer, but at the same time, if you've got a source of goals out, then surely you try and find room for a centre-forward a bit more often, and I don't understand it. As Chris said to an earlier point, you start looking for flaws in logic and then you just don't stop.
That almost, given Gayle that contract to me, almost felt like punting it into the long grass and making it somebody else's problem further down the line. You know, it wasn't a progressive move, was it? I don't think it was very forward thinking, but it was essentially just, well, you know, let's just keep him here. There's nobody else. We might as well just give him an extension.
Yeah, exactly, and it has done those things. It's just that it's now, I mean, so if you think about how much Carroll played last season, I mean, I know largely ineffectually, or, you know, he would argue differently, but 18 appearances. So you haven't got that, and now you've not got Dwight Gayle featuring either. It's just a very strange position to be in, and You would have thought, again, albeit if you put Dwight Gayle on the pitch, you have to take somebody else off, and it's a different, slightly different way of playing. He's someone who's spent his entire career scoring goals. So, and that was the one thing that Newcastle needed at the weekend. So, you know, it's not necessarily straightforward. I think when Gayle has started matches, you do come away thinking that's not the answer. But at the same time, you know, Newcastle have players out and have Wilson out, and if you want to score a goal, then the best person to do that is presumably a striker.
Chris, the back three / back five appears to have been jettisoned, but based on you know, the teams that we're playing and stuff like that, do you see Steve Bruce reintroducing the back three / back five?
Well, I actually asked Steve Bruce on Saturday after the game about changing to the formation, to which he replied with, "I think the statistics, Chris, I will give you them." To then he went on to give an answer where he didn't give me any statistics in it, other than to say that Newcastle changed to a back four, after, well, a back yeah. five, sorry, after they lost to Brighton last season. But he basically finished his answer by saying, you've got to have the ability to change. Certainly, we have played well in the last couple with it, referring to a back four. So, look, we concentrate on that for next week also. So I think that at least in the short term, that this is going to be the way Newcastle are going to play. We've said, basically, since the first podcast of this season, I said to you, Taylor, that there were concerns from some people inside the club that as soon as things started to go wrong, the formation that they worked so long on would be binned and they'd move on to something else. They are looking better playing this way. I haven't really got an issue with switching towards that, but it's not a foolproof system. There's no foolproof way of just changing the squad. It comes back to the short blanket, the Rafa Benitez quote. There's still some issues here, and I think that Newcastle are creating more opportunities this way. They actually didn't... they did ship a lot of chances, if you look at the statistics on Saturday, but a lot of them were from distance that Watford had. They didn't. But I do think that better teams will expose the likes of Matt Ritchie at left-back, the lack of pace in the middle of the park, in the middle of Newcastle's central defence. So there are issues with it, but I do think that 4-3-3 is here to stay at least for the next few weeks.
I bet they go to three at the back against Chelsea. But then that's all five at the back against Chelsea. But I mean, I'm only saying that because I think he might, perhaps that might be the way forward. I mean, the other point is talking about short blankets and all that sort of stuff. One of the, you could tell at the start of this season, really, it was a system built around Shelvey, and Shelvey's been out. And so what happens when Shelvey comes back? Does he try and find a place for Shelvey? And how does he do that? And how does he offer protection around that? So, I mean, I just... There's no... You know, Newcastle are still unbalanced. They have this lack of balance in the squad. And again, we're just going... I mean, this is an old... It's old arguments to go through, but I don't think there is an obvious answer. You know, I don't think there's a catch-all answer. But it's like we're sort of searching for this magic formula, and I don't think it exists. I mean, I just do not think it exists.
One of the positives that's come out of the last couple of games, I thought, was Miguel Almirón, probably from the Man United game onwards. I think he's looked like he's been a lot more freed up in this slightly changed formation, slightly changed position that he's being used in. And he seems to be getting the ball a lot more and getting forward a lot more and stuff like that, and a bit more the old Miggy that we had beforehand. With the 5-3-2, it does seem to nullify him somewhat, Chris, doesn't
it? Yeah, I mean, I've raised this sort of issue previously many times with the Miguel Almirón when he's playing as a midfielder or as a number eight, whatever, however you want to say. He will always work hard. He will always do the defensive element there. But I thought he was shackled in what he could do, whereas in the last game and two-thirds, we've seen a lot more of what he can do in terms of in broken play, driving forward with the ball. He's never going to score that regularly because I don't think he's that composed once he gets in front of goal, but I do think that he can be so devastating in tandem with Sam Maximan and Willock, that those sorts of players driving forward from deep. And I like, that's what I've seen from Newcastle. I think that the previous system, he couldn't do as much of that. Willock was more suited to that role, although he looked good in a 4-3-3, I thought, on Saturday. So yeah, I think that this hopefully will bring a bit more out of Miguel Almirón.
Absolutely. George, do you feel like Bruce's lack of a tactical strategy is more so a result of the transfer policy of the club, maybe?
Well, I mean, one of my long-term theories is that, you know, is that the summer that he arrived disrupted a huge amount. And so, again, I'm not trying to give him excuses here, because I think 2 and a bit years down the line, I think Newcastle should be in better shape. But, you know, bringing in Gillinton again, a player that, you know, they had no idea what to do with, replacing a player that he wasn't equipped to replace, you know, was just such a bonkers, bizarre, crazy, illogical thing to do. Obviously losing Perez, obviously losing Rondon, although, you know, that was the club's decision. And I think it's sort of taken a long time. I mean, there was no obvious tactical solution at the start. I think he's taken far too long to, you know, to kind of come up with an answer. I think that's not unduly harsh. He has been undermined this summer by the club only bringing in Joe Willock, and so the options that he wanted at centre half and in midfield haven't been delivered. So, I mean, you know, all managers want more players all the time. I mean, that goes without saying. But I mean, yes, I think he has been undermined from within, albeit, you know, the first summer he wasn't within at that point, really, because all of those deals were, you know, none of those deals were his, although that he signed them off. And, you know, that stuff makes life more difficult. Having said all of that, though, I still think Newcastle should be better and should be more, what's the word I'm looking for? What's the word I'm sort of stretching for? I think there should just be more sort of rigorousness and more organisation in the way that they play.
Yeah. I think there needs to be more care. I think there needs to be a little bit more care and a little bit more thought put into this. I know you're saying, you know, Steve Bruce has been slightly hung out to dry by the club and their transfer policy, but at the end of the day, it is his job to get the best out of this squad, and that's what he's paid to do. And unfortunately, in my opinion, it feels like he's not doing that at the moment. Chris, the Matt Ritchie thing, you mentioned that briefly a second ago. Aaron Kay here on the real-time feed has asked, while I can see the logic in Ritchie ahead of Lewis at left wing-back, and while not necessarily agreeing with it, how on earth can Ritchie be considered a better left-back option?
Well, I asked Steve Bruce on Friday before Newcastle had shifted to the full permanently. I asked him whether Matt Ritchie was someone he would consider playing in a back four, or whether he'd only done that against Leeds because he'd shifted within the game. And his response was basically, in the modern game, in his opinion, there isn't too much difference between left wing back and left back. That's paraphrasing. That was sort of what he said. And I was a little bit taken aback by that. He did play Matt Ritchie on Saturday, and I was a little bit shocked that after Saw drew booking out of him in the first 15 minutes that they didn't really try to run down his channel again, because both fullbacks actually were booked quite early on. And I am concerned when he comes up against better opposition, him playing as a left back. And if Jamal Lewis can't play in a four at this moment in time, you do question again, where is he going to play? That's another strange signing. That was more than a year ago now. Newcastle paid $15 million for Jamal Lewis, and we've barely seen him in 2021. That is concerned. I don't really understand that as an option. I mean, I don't see him on training every week. Steve Bruce hasn't spoken that much about Jamal Lewis recently, but you have to be concerned if Matt Ritchie, who really is a right winger by trade, is playing left back ahead of Jamal Lewis when he's fit. Then I think that is a cause for concern as to how they see Jamal Lewis developing.
And also, George, quick review, ASRM has asked, if Graham Jones is our attacking coach, who is our defensive coach, and are they not working on defending corners?
Well, Graham Jones is not Newcastle's attacking coach, so I hope that clears up a little bit. I think that's come from the BBC Newcastle interview that Steve Bruce did, when he did say that on that day, Graham Jones was working on the attacking side, and that he and Steve Agnew, I think, had been working on the defensive side, but that they switch it up. They switch it up all the time. So there's no Graham Jones is a coach, as are the others. That there are no specific coaches for position apart from goalkeeping coach. But at the same time, I do sort of understand the question. I mean, if you're looking at Newcastle's defensive record this season and how vulnerable they look at the back, it is startling. And that is the other side, you know, that's the other side to the stats we were talking about at the top about creating more chances and having more shots and stuff like that. They look incredibly vulnerable. And I think that shifting defence, and now shifting goalkeeper as well, doesn't necessarily, you know, definitely doesn't help, but it's something he's felt necessary to keep doing to try and find an answer. But yeah, no, it's been very slack at the back.
So just time for a few reasons to be cheerful, chaps, before we finish up for the week. George, what's your thoughts?
Well, it's a bit of an obvious one, but it's when we're talking about stats, I do just want to praise Steve Bruce's running stats. Because if you've not seen this clip, please just stick it into Twitter. In fact, go on to Alan's and Maximo's Twitter feed, because there's a great clip from FIFA 22 where Almiron, I believe, scores a winning
penalty. I mean, that's the most unbelievable part of this.
Well, yeah, and the fact that Newcastle have actually won a game. And then from the sidelines, the entire team pelt forward to greet Almiron, and they're all overtaken by Steve Bruce, which is it's astonishing, and it does look exactly like Steve Bruce. Does. It's just wonderful. It's very very
kicks
funny.
Kicks the afterburners and, in, doesn't he? It's amazing.
Yeah, and Alain Saint-Maximin has gone on to Twitter to say, "Hey FIFA, how come Steve Bruce's running stats are quicker than mine?"
He said, "How come I only got 91 pace and Steve Bruce has got 99?"
But it is brilliant. It is beautiful. It's very funny.
Chris, how about you, mate? Reasons to be cheerful?
I have a slightly contentious one. Oh. It's a miserable
you
statistic,
are slightly
but one which.
Chris.
Oh, negative Nelly. Negative Nelly.
Gives me encouragement. So, this is courtesy of Opta Joe.
Oh.
Newcastle may be winless, but so are four other Premier League teams so far after six games: Norwich, Burnley, Leeds, and Southampton. And it is only the second time that has happened since 1964-65 in the top flight. So there are four other crap teams. So that is where I'm going to take a crumb of comfort and say that potentially three of them may finish below Newcastle this season.
So Chris, just to be clear, your reason to be cheerful is that Newcastle United are shit, but there are also four other teams that are shit as well. That's basically what you're saying.
Correct.
Good. Okay.
Yeah. Fine.
Excellent.
What's yours?
I don't know. We had 20 shots on goal. We haven't lost for two games.
We've already done that. We've done that.
I don't know, George.
I have a deflating stat to go with that. So the last time Newcastle managed just to have that many shots on goal away from home in the Premier League was in October 2015 when they lost 3-0 at Sunderland. In the
going
down. So let's hope that's not an omen.
Steve McNair.
Incredible stuff.
Well, that's a cheerful ending.
Reasons.
That's a really cheerful ending to Reasons to be Cheerful, isn't it? Well done, Chris.
Thanks for that, Chris. That's really helped. Oh, well. Just to finish off as well, announced this morning, former Newcastle United centre defender Stephen Taylor has announced his retirement, been plying his trade over in New Zealand, and apparently had just recently been made captain for the forthcoming season, and now has decided that he's hanging up his boots. Stephen Taylor was one of those characters, when he George, he always give it all, but he had some incredible moments in black and white, didn't he? And I think the sniper in the Leeds' end was probably one of the ones that a lot of people can remember. And him celebrating Ryan Taylor's goal against Sunderland as if he'd scored it himself. That was another one as well. Stephen Taylor, retiring at the age of 35.
Yeah, very good centre-half, but absolutely outstanding at amateur dramatics, and surely a career now or certainly a hobby lies ahead of him, because I just think he needs to hone his craft a little bit. But in terms of enthusiasm, amateur dramatics, possibly even something professional. He's got another career there. There's another great clip on Twitter of him before Johan Gabay scores a wonderful free kick, of him just standing in front of the Stoke goalkeeper, imitating him every time he raises an arm or two arms or says something, and he runs back into the wall, then runs back out again, and basically just behaves like the biggest adolescent dickhead you could possibly imagine. But then Newcastle score, and it's very,
it
very
is.
Funny.
Excellent. I remember that day very well. There we go. Stephen Taylor, king of shithousery, retiring at the age of 35. Wonderful stuff. And just before we go as well, some sad news this week. We learned that former Newcastle boss and director of football as well, Joe Kinnear, has been diagnosed with dementia. And obviously we'd like to send him our best regards, and I'm sure everybody listening to the podcast as well would like to send our thoughts out to Joe and to his family as well. Sad news this week. Right, that's it. We'll be back for another episode next week of Pod on the Tyne. Thanks to Chris and George. Always a pleasure. Chaps, look after yourselves and have a good week. And thanks to all of you lot for listening as well. Take care of yourselves and bye for now.
The Athletic.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together, because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.